get started. So experiment two is this week. That'll be due a week from today. I think every group except one has had their lab session. Comments on experiment two? Questions? Yeah, fine time. For the extra credit, I would recommend you do your calculations first. Right, that's one you want to not have to do by guess and check. Verify that things are matching for the actual lab, and then be relatively quick to go in there. So once you have that calculation, let me know, email me, and we'll set up a time where we can let you in there. Other questions, comments on experiment two? Complaints? I think we only had two fail. We were able to replace those and bring them back alive. How much do they cost? The power stage itself is some $15, I think. Actually, last minute made a decision to switch to that. There's something that's a little bit nicer and has things already populated that you can buy, but they're $100 each, which is probably okay if they survive. But then we switched to these at the last minute. So not a big deal. It's somewhat expected that some of these things are going to fail. Power electronics are difficult. You got a whole lot of real power going into something, a lot of switching and noise. You have significant stored energy in your filter elements. Things happen, like things get disconnected, or really with any circuit, if you overvoltage it or plug in voltages backwards, they blow. And that happens. No group blew up four boards on their own, so I'm happy.
In the field, mm-hmm. you would ideally have a board or a control system that would kind of adjust all the duty cycle and the power. That would do all that all for you to get the maximum power out of that fan.
Right. So that, maybe we skirted a little bit. Maximum power point tracking is a little bit different from the control that we're talking about in this class. The reason is, well, because of the details of the panel. So if I look at this IV relationship, something like this, which means that if I'm at this maximum power point, my kind of impedance from the panel, I can model it as some resistance. This is I over V. This is 1 over capital R. So I could do a model, large signal model, this panel that looked like a voltage source in series with some resistance. Problem is, when I go to small signal, and with my small signal approximation, I'm taking a derivative at this operating point. The slope of this thing looks like some 1 over lowercase r, my small signal, where lowercase r is less than 0. So I have a model where I have now a negative resistor, and that becomes somewhat difficult to stabilize. So a typical approach to these MPPT systems is you actually don't design them as small signal controllers like we're covering in class now. You design them as algorithmic controllers. That is you just have a microprocessor, and it says, okay, change the duty cycle. Did the power go up? If so, keep changing it. If it went down, go the other way. And then you just kind of step around until you get to the maximum power point, and then that type of controller will just oscillate between two points directly adjacent to the maximum power point in steady state. Okay. That's kind of at a very high level mentioned in the lab report, where it says, okay, there's kind of two reasons why we add this battery. One is that we want to be able to have continuous power flow. We want to be able to charge a you know, use this as a USB charger any time of the day, even if it's at night. So some energy storage will decouple, okay, when is the sun available from when do we want power? But also it decouples those controls. I can't simultaneously regulate maximum power and regulate output voltage where the load dictates how much power it wants. We decouple these things. And then for an application, it would depend. If you have maybe a higher quality system, you'd put this algorithmic type tracking control. Maybe on a cheaper system, you just do a fixed duty cycle. Because as you've now noticed, maximum power voltage for the panel is kind of similar across all different installation levels. Okay? The current changes widely, the resistance changes widely, but the voltage is pretty similar. You can get close enough just by having a fixed voltage. So if I have a battery at the output, I can set a duty cycle and have it be close to the maximum power. Okay. Answer your question?
Yes. Okay. So is that the control loop, all that implemented in the microcontroller?
So that algorithmic section would be, or maybe some dedicated IC that you buy. But it's called this algorithmic control. It's not just a linear controller that I can describe as some transfer function, because it's making a decision. Sense power, has it gone up from the last step or not? That sort of decision making I can't do with an op amp or some transfer function. So it doesn't fall into the realm where linear control analysis will describe it. It's actually quite difficult to model that and prove stability of it, but you do it kind of slow, it's going to be stable, fine. Other questions? Okay. Any feedback on the experiment? Curious. People may not be willing to voice that publicly. I'll find some way to have kind of an anonymous feedback on that. I'd like to know whether or not you guys are finding these to be useful or a waste of time.
I feel like once we actually figured out exactly what to do and what everything represented, it was actually like, it was a good way to learn.
Yeah.
It took a while for our group to actually see what to do and exactly what.
Yeah, and I apologize for that. Unfortunately, this one's a bit confounded by having to use a current sink at the output, and that's not anything about the system we're trying to work with. That's just this electronic load will oscillate with the current limit on the voltage supply if we set it as a voltage sink. We really plan to do that, but if you go past the maximum power point, things start to oscillate and potentially get damaged. And rather than saying, well, be very careful not to go there, well, this way it'll always be stable. So that's not a characteristic of the converter and the PV panel. It's just something about the equipment. And that makes it a little bit, takes maybe a second to grasp, why are we doing it this way to get to this point instead of just always having it be 8 volts. I apologize for that, but it was deemed necessary. Okay. Well, let's move on with the content of the course. So last time we were getting into this closed loop control. So we took what we had done in terms of modeling our power converter with AC linearized small signal equations, putting those in the circuit and then solving transfer functions, applying superposition. This thing in the dashed box here is the model of our power converter itself, and everything else models the feedback loop around it. We found that we can analyze the closed loop transfer functions of this system, solve for an expression for those closed loop transfer functions from reference or either the disturbances to the output. That expression is simplified if we talk about this loop gain, defining our loop gain as the negative of the gain around the feedback loop. Okay. Then what we get is, for example, for our reference, a closed loop transfer function is the ideal closed loop transfer function times this T over 1 plus T, and we'll track our ideal fairly well if our loop gain is large. Same thing for the disturbances. We'd like the input voltage and load current to have no impact on the output voltage that we're trying to regulate. leave that slide in, yeah. So as long as the loop gain is large, for example, my transfer function from output current to output voltage goes to zero over frequencies where the loop gain is large. So our goal is to design this feedback system with a very large loop gain. What that'll do is it'll give me ideal tracking of my reference, an ideal rejection of my disturbances. Another nice thing about it is under these simplifications, so for a reference and a disturbance, my closed loop transfer function from reference to output, 1 over h times t over 1 plus t. If t is very large, such that I can approximate the second term as going to 1, then this transfer function depends only on h, which is that resistor divider. As long as t is very large, it has no dependence on how I modeled the power stage. So if I was a little bit off in my inductor capacitor, or my loss mechanisms weren't quite right, all of those minor sources of error can get drowned out by feedback over the range of frequencies where t is large. And that range does depend on the model of the plant. But as long as I have a lot of loop gain, I'm insensitive to minor variations in components or losses, as well as being insensitive to disturbances. So I'll have ideal tracking, good output voltage. So this, just looking at an example loop gain, so I have kind of a range of frequencies down here where my loop gain is very large. Down there, I should have really good regulation. Then at some point, my loop gain crosses 0 dB, which is unity, continues going down. Up here, I have very low loop gain, and I'm going to get almost no effect of my feedback network. I'm just going to get the open loop behavior of the system. And then here, in the vicinity of where my loop gain crosses 0 dB, is the real area of interest where there's some nuance to this, what happens there. Okay. This one we also looked at, okay, in steady state, what sort of error do I expect? And I can calculate that by using the same equation, 1 over h times t over 1 plus t. And if I'm concerned about steady state, that is, on the frequency plot, that's a DC. I take my DC gain. If I wanted to know how well can this system track a reference that varies at 60 hertz, if I was trying to make an inverter, my reference, I'd change it as a 60 hertz sine wave, and I'd want my feedback loop to be able to track that and make the output a 60 hertz sine wave. If I wanted to know how much error I'd have, then I could look at 60 hertz and then do 1 over h times t of 60 hertz over 1 plus t of 60 hertz that tell me how much error and amplitude I have in tracking a 60 hertz reference. Okay. I can do that at any individual frequency, with DC being the steady state. So, effective feedback. There's a lot of good things that come from adding this feedback loop. We can use it to alter the frequency response, specifically by altering the pole of the open loop system, move those poles in our closed loop system to an area more favorable. Things we can make system immune to disturbances and plant variations. As long as my loop gain is large, if I have disturbances coming in, or if my model of the power converter has a little bit of error in it, that error isn't going to affect my ability to regulate the output voltage. If I have this large loop gain, that's going to drive it to where it needs to go, even if this model is a little bit off. Okay. Bad news is we don't design this carefully, we could go unstable. Okay. So everything up to this point, we had some discussion on this yesterday, but everything on the slide, say, okay, make the loop gain infinity everywhere, everything's perfect. Problem is that'll lead to an unstable system. What we're going to look at now is how do we assess stability of a closed loop system? Decide when it's going to go unstable. Okay, so in general, Nyquist stability theorem gives the criterion to assess stability of a closed loop system. That's a little bit more involved, a little bit more background theory required to apply that. What we're going to do is we're going to use a special case of the Nyquist stability theorem, which is the phase margin test. Phase margin test is valid for certain types of systems. So that are going to be the types of systems that we work with in this class, fortunately. But I'm going to require two things. One, my loop gain has no right half plane poles, which will always be true for the systems that we're going to look at. And then second, I need my crossover frequency was the frequency where the magnitude of the loop gain is equal to 0 dB. It needs to be uniquely defined. So I need my loop gain to cross 0 dB exactly once. This one will be true for the systems we look at. This one will remain true as long as you don't do something weird with your compensation, but can be made true by your design. So with those two things being valid, then we can use this phase margin test, which is a simpler way to assess stability of these types of systems. The phase margin test itself is quite simple. Phase margin is this here. So it's 180 degrees plus the phase of the loop gain at the crossover frequency. Okay. So if I have versus frequency, I'm plotting the phase of T. It does something like this. This down here is minus 180 degrees, 0 degrees. This is my crossover frequency. This is the phase margin. Phase margin, 180 degrees plus the phase, and more accurately, minus 180 degrees minus the negative of the phase, but it is how far above minus 180 degrees the phase of my loop gain is at the crossover frequency. Okay. So as an example, here is one loop gain, magnitude on top, phase, the bottom curve, phase margin, I evaluate at crossover frequency, go down, find the phase of the system, and then compare it to minus 180 degrees. In this case, my phase is more negative than minus 180 degrees, minus 230 degrees. My phase margin is 180 minus 230 is 50 degrees, which is less than zero. So my system is unstable. Okay, that's kind of a rote definition. Understanding of exactly these stability criterion kind of in a formal sense would require going back to Nyquist stability. In an informal sense, I can make an argument here about why this thing would go unstable. And to do so, what I'm going to look at is when the phase crosses minus 180 here, if I go up, this system has some large gain. Okay. So got my system, got G to my output, some feedback loop, gain through a compensator, negative feedback, my reference coming in. And I'm going to look at what happens if, for whatever reason, I get a disturbance exactly at this frequency. Call this F sub X. So that F sub X, for some reason, unbeknownst to me, noise or otherwise, my output here, our typical converter, we'll call this D hat, has some magnitude of a disturbance at F sub X. So what's going to happen? If it's purely that frequency, then I can just look at the frequency response for the system here. It's going to have a lot of gain. So as it goes through the feedback loop, I'm going to amplify up that disturbance. And it's got exactly minus 180 degrees of phase. Okay. In AC, if I have a sinusoid, I put it 180 degrees out of phase, the same thing as just doing the negative of it, right? A sine 180 degrees shifted is negative sine 0 degrees shifted. So it's actually an inversion. And that means that when I go back through my feedback loop, now I am inverting once to get negative feedback. But if that loop has 180 degrees of phase shift, I'm inverting twice and I've got positive feedback with a very large gain. So I've got this disturbance, some magnitude here at F sub X. That's going to go through my feedback and come through as now a larger version of that disturbance. Okay. Because 180 degrees of phase shift, I'm getting positive feedback. There is no inversion of it and a lot of gain, so it comes back larger. Then this new amplitude goes back through, it becomes bigger and bigger. And then eventually this thing runs away and is unstable. Okay. So somewhat of a qualitative argument for why this is unstable. Here's a different system. This one, the phase of the loop gain at the crossover frequency is now greater than 180. It's minus 112. Minus 112 plus 180 is 68 degrees. My phase margin here greater than zero. So this is a stable system. For this example system, the phase never crosses minus 180, so I never have any system where I have, or any frequencies where I would have this positive feedback. Even if I added some kind of additional pole out here that allowed it to go down and cross minus 180. So at this frequency, now I'll have kind of the same argument. I have positive feedback, but the gain is much less than one. So as that goes through the system, it's going to get attenuated, get smaller, and eventually stamp out and go away. I won't have the same sort of instability. Okay. So generally the conclusions of the phase margin test are that if you have greater than 0 degrees of phase margin, your system will be stable. The question then becomes, okay, if I have 0.01 degrees of phase margin, technically a stable system, probably that's not a great idea because it's exactly on the boundary of being completely unstable. So how much phase margin is required? So a small amount of phase margin is going to lead to a system that's just barely stable, and it's going to have a whole lot of ringing and overshoot. Okay. at exactly phase margin is equal to zero, the system would just ring out indefinitely. It's not unstable. It's not going to run away, but it'll just ring forever. Okay. Increasing the phase margin will lead to a system that has less ringing and less overshoot, but the trade-off with that is it's going to be a slower system to respond. So what we're going to look at is the relationship between phase margin and Q. Taking some slides from the book here, the Q it's talking about is Q closed loop. I think the notation's not great here, but we're not thinking about the Q of the power stage, the Q that you solved in the transfer functions for GVD. Instead, we're thinking about the Q of the closed loop transfer functions. Okay. So first, just an example. Here are some curves of a step response of the system up top for varying degrees of phase margin. 90 degrees of phase margin is this curve here. It has this nice, purely exponential response. Something with much smaller, 13 degrees of phase margin, is this outer one that has a damped ringing response. It rings out for a while. Phase margins in between, kind of the continuity between those two. But if I keep going down from 13 degrees, the rate at which this ringing damps out will get lower. 0 degrees, it'll just ring the whole time. Okay. So to assess this, what we're going to look at is a second order system, which is in some sense just an example, but also going to be very valid for all of the type of systems that we're going to look at. And what this goes back to is way back when I made this argument of, okay, stuff that's happening up here doesn't really matter. The loop gain's big and closed loop, my T over 1 plus T is going to go to 1. I don't care so much what's going on over here. I have good regulation. Out here, my loop gain's much less than 1. I don't really care what's going on. My loop gains, my feedback system's doing nothing. Okay. It's really only right here that has some nuance to it. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at a system where we really only care about what's going on in this range. Okay. So in this range, I can model the system this way and move this omega 2 pole around. If omega 2 is back here, then I will cross through 0 dB at minus 40 dB per decade. If omega 2, if my second pole is out here, I'm going to cross at minus 20 dB per decade. And kind of in the vicinity of my crossover frequency, things aren't affected at all if I have, you know, an extra pole up here, an extra zero, or an extra zero here. This isn't going to affect what my system looks like in the vicinity of the crossover, either magnitude or phase. Okay. We're going to consider this simplified system, but it's actually going to be fairly valid conclusions for systems even that have more poles than zeros, as long as in the vicinity of the crossover, there's kind of one pole that matters. Okay. It's going down at least minus 20 dB per decade, and there's one pole that is close to this. Any other poles and zeros are further away from my crossover frequency. Okay. So what I can do is I can, at the cross for the crossover frequency here, I can move the second pole around. This pole contributes kind of between 1/10 and 10 times its frequency, it's going to contribute 90 degrees of phase lag. So if I move that pole to the left, this phase drop-off is going to move to the left and my phase margin will decrease. As I move it to the right, this phase will happen way over here and I'll have 90 degrees of phase margin. Okay. So by moving that second pole around, I can alter the phase margin of the system. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. So then if I care only about in the vicinity of the crossover frequency, I can take this system and I can go ahead and solve analytically what is T over 1 plus T. I get an expression that looks like this, and this is the closed loop Q, which I don't want you to confuse with the Q of the power stage, which is that they're both Qs of two different things, though, different values. Okay. So this closed loop Q looks like radical ratio of these two frequencies, and then the crossover frequency is geometric mean of them. So if I take this expression and look at it, okay, similar things are going to apply to what we looked at before. This is, even though it's a different system, this is still the Q of the system. If Q is less than a half, this is going to break into two real poles. Q is greater than a half, I'm going to have in my Bode plot some peaking. Okay. We have those two cases. So on the next slide, here's just the results for it. So here's my closed loop step response versus the closed loop Q. This one goes a little bit further. So if I have extremely low Q, you can see this problem associated with the speed of the response. So this is a very nicely damped response. It's going to have no ringing, but it's going to take stinking forever to get there. So I have a very high Q closed loop. I'm going to have a lot of ringing. I'm going to be very close to an unstable system. And then in the middle, I have kind of a continuity of different responses. A couple interesting points. Q is equal to 0.5. This is the boundary where I'll have no overshoot. And then Q is equal to 1, the highest Q I can have where I have no ringing. So this Q is equal to 1, we'll have some overshoot, but it'll damp back down in one cycle. End up at the steady state output, Q is equal to half, won't overshoot at all, just steadily rise to its final value. So looking at this second order system then, solving for T over 1 plus T, two cases. This is the low Q case, so the Q is less than a half. In this case, my original loop gain here had second pole well above the crossover frequency. That's going to result in my T over 1 plus T looking like this, but with some Q less than a half, which means that I can approximate this again with two poles, Q omega and omega over Q. So I can split, instead of having a negative Q, model this with two real poles. Okay. So as my Q gets more negative, what I would have is a system where these two poles split even further. My Q gets more negative and dB are just smaller. Q is, say this is Q is 0.3, this might be Q is 0.1. If I keep going, based on how I do this pole splitting, those two poles are going to get further and further away. And you can see now when I split these, the lower Q is, the smaller my range where T over 1 plus T is pretty much just unity is. Okay, so that's going to mean I have a smaller frequency range where I have very good regulation. that smaller frequency range is what correlates with this slower response. Okay. The frequency range where my loop gain is very large is the frequency range where I can do a good job of tracking and responding to disturbances. That, as we said before, the crossover frequency roughly correlates with the closed loop bandwidth. So as I push this first pole way back, I'm limiting my bandwidth and slowing down my system. Okay. So this is the case where I have very low Q. If I have very high Q, Q is greater than 0.5. Now, in my loop gain, the way I get there is I've moved this second pole back before the crossover frequency. My loop gain crosses 0 dB at this minus 40 dB per decade slope, instead of minus 20 dB per decade as it was before. So the difference between two cases here, F2 is less than the crossover frequency here. This one, F2 came above the crossover frequency. I'm just moving that second pole back until it comes before I hit 0 dB. What it's going to do is it caused my loop gain to cross 0 dB at minus 40 dB per decade. Then when I do T over 1 plus T, loop gain's big, it looks like unity. Then loop gain small, it looks like loop gain. So I have this break point where I go from 0 to minus 40 dB per decade. I'm going to have a large Q. That allows me to do is push my bandwidth out, so my bandwidth is still up higher. My crossover frequency is at a higher frequency. I've got a wide range of frequencies. For my T over 1 plus T is unity. So I'll have a fast response. But I have this peaking here, which means that, hey, this is my closed loop transfer function. It means that I'm going to track my reference very well here, but anything in these frequencies is going to get amplified. I expect to see in my closed loop response amplification at these frequencies or ringing here. So these are going to be, this frequency range is where you're going to see ringing in your step response. If I had numbers to it, this would correspond to the frequency of this ringing. Okay. Okay, so those are characteristics of the closed loop system. In the end, what we want to know is, okay, if we understand that, how do I design phase margin based on this closed loop Q in order to get some behavior that I want? Okay, so this went through, solved for the exact Q versus phase margin, some expression that's not so important, exactly the details, but here's a plot of what it looks like. So generally, there's a relationship where higher phase margin means lower Q. In both cases, that means making the system more stable. Okay. So there are these breakpoints we talked about. Q is equal to 1. This was where we had no ringing. Still a little bit of overshoot. It would overshoot, but then damp right out. Q is equal to 1/2. This is where we had no overshoot at all. Those correspond to no ringing at phase margins greater than 52 degrees and no overshoot at phase margins greater than 76 degrees. Depending on the system you're designing, one of these might be good targets for phase margin. Right? You really can't tolerate any overshoot, then phase margin needs to be greater than 76 degrees. You can tolerate a little bit of overshoot, but don't want the response to ring out for a long time. 52 degrees might be a good target phase margin. Okay. Phase margin goes close to 0. We get this very high Q. We're going to have a lot of ringing and a lot of problems with our response. And then if phase margin goes up above 90, very low Q, which is a good thing in terms of ringing, but may lead to a very slow response, depending on how it's implemented. Okay. So, just want to summarize here, when we're looking at the loop gain, because we're going to be doing kind of our design of these systems from the loop gain and shaping the loop gain with the compensator transfer function, there are kind of a number of characteristics that we're going to be concerned about. A number of things that we want to get, characteristics that we want to get out of this feedback system. Okay. So when we look at the loop gain, things we want, so get zero steady state error. We want the low frequency loop gain to be approaching infinity, or if not, at least very large. It's going to mean when we look at GC, T over 1 plus T term is very large, and my output is going to track my reference. Okay. If we don't have high gain at low frequency, then there's going to be residual error. Even once any transients die out, our output is not going to be exactly what our reference tells it to be. Okay. So I'm going to design that to be very large. Additionally, beyond that, if this is just a DC to DC converter, I care about steady state error, the DC output. If this is a system with some input or output frequency, like an inverter or a rectifier, then I'm going to care about the loop gain at that frequency, because it's going to tell me how much error I have at that frequency in my tracking. I mentioned earlier, if it's a 60 hertz inverter, I want very high gain at 60 hertz, but at the output, I'll get what my reference commands for the 60 hertz sinusoid that my inverter is trying to produce. Okay. You get a fast response. We want F sub C, which is equal to the frequency at which magnitude of the loop gain is equal to 1. F sub C is the solution to this, what frequency the magnitude of the loop gain hits 0 dB to be as large as possible. We'd like to have a high crossover frequency, which means a wide range of frequencies over which the loop gain is large, and my feedback can track, reject disturbances and track references. Okay. Then the limit to that is get a stable system. We need the phase margin to be greater than 0 degrees. How much greater depends on the design. Roughly, this chart will tell us for dominantly second order systems in the vicinity of the crossover frequency how phase margin relates to closed loop Q, which then relates to system response to any disturbance. Okay. This is valid for, like I said, any system where in the vicinity of the crossover frequency, the only thing that really matters is a single pole going down at minus 20 dB per decade. And then my closest pole to the crossover is either below or above it. I've got one that's close or zero. Let this go far away. But if I have kind of a pole here and another pole here, this will be a little bit errant in predicting exactly how phase margin corresponds to closed loop response. But very rarely are we going to have systems with that behavior. So we're going to compensate to eliminate that. Okay. So those are the kinds of things we want to do with loop gain analytically. There's one more that I'll add here that's more of a practical thing. So we want high attenuation. Or magnitude of T much less than one for frequencies at and above the switching frequency. Okay. So we've spent a while now in this reference frame of looking at our average linearized AC model. Keep in mind, those are constructed, mathematically derived models for the switching power converter. And one of the steps in that was averaging away all of the ripple and all the harmonics at and above the switching frequency. Okay. In the real system, there is still this ripple, and it can be pretty nasty. In addition to the ripple we saw, there's switching ripple. We've seen now in experiment two, kind of how the switch node has this huge overshoot and ringing. There's a lot of stuff going on at very high frequency, and we don't want to have, where's the loop gain? Let's say I took this loop gain, and I'm kind of okay with the low frequency gain that's high enough to give me low steady state error. I'm okay with the bandwidth here. I think roughly 500 hertz is good for my bandwidth. Okay with the phase margin, 68 degrees is enough. But let me make a modification to it. Say what would happen if there was then a zero here that caused my gain to flatten out to high frequency. Okay. From everything I've shown so far, that's no problem. Okay. But the problem is somewhere out here, let's say my switching frequency is here. I have very little attenuation of that, and I'm going to have a massive amount of switching frequency component on my alpha voltage just due to any small ripple. That only gets attenuated by 10 dB. It only gets cut by a factor of 2. Then all of that switching noise is going to be circulating through my system all the time, and it's going to cause a lot of problems. Saturate things, problems with discerning the signal from that. So we don't want that. We want to make sure that we go down and have a whole lot of attenuation at the switching frequency. Okay. One reason is for noise and rejection from switching ripple. The other is due to uncertainty. Because we have averaged the entire system at the switching frequency, our model is not correct here. Okay. We had to make this step of averaging and removing any sort of dynamics at the switching frequency and above to get a linear system. But what that did is it made us have a system where we've just destroyed all of the dynamics here. So the real system, as you get close to the switching frequency, will be significantly different from your model. And we've lost that information. So we're always going to design with a crossover frequency roughly a decade below the switching frequency and make sure we have good attenuation up here so that whatever's actually going on is drowned out. Okay. So we'll kind of add that here. In addition to this, so we want F sub C as large as possible, subject to stability. And even if our model says we can, F sub C should be less than FS over 5 at most. FS over 10 is probably a better safe margin to be a decade below the switching frequency, because we go up there, that requires us to analyze dynamics that aren't in our model right now, are much more complicated to analyze. Okay. We don't have them in there, but it's okay. We talked about when we were looking at the modulator, there's no possible way to control at the switching frequency, because my converter only gets to decide on one duty cycle per switching period, so there's no way I can control any faster than that anyway. There's not any advantage to saying, let's get a new model where we know what's going on here. It's just going to tell us, still, put your crossover frequency less than the switching frequency by maybe a factor of 2 if we had a more complex model instead of a factor of 5. We don't gain much out of that. Okay? So these are the things we want to do. In the next class, what we're going to get into is, how do we do that? And the way that we do it is we design this compensator transfer function in order to shape the overall loop gain to get these favorable characteristics. We'll pick up there next week. Have a good weekend. Thank you.